Okay, so the story that you heard, well put, will just be my introduction. Moshe sent spies to assess the land, and they found it flowing with milk and honey. But, as was read in the Parsha, the people came back, and 10 of the 12 spies had this report to give. They said, and there we saw the Nephilim. Now, we're going to do a little word study. Nephilim is from the Hebrew letters Nun, Fe, Lamed, which we'll get to in a minute, but it says the sons of Anak, and Min Anephilim, sons of the giant, and in our eyes, it'll say later, but Nephilim. Now, there's a lot of speculation about who these Nephilim were, so we should address that little factual factoid, you might say. It's from the word Nafal. Here's the three root letters, from to fall, to drop, to decline, to collapse, to be defeated. So some say that it means these were fallen people. Some say these were fallen angels. And there's been a lot of phantasmagoric speculation about that. This is the cover from the cover of our bulletin. And it's a reconstruction of a giant skeleton found in Loja, I guess you'd say it, in Ecuador. And it's about 25 feet tall. And they only found some fragments. And if you get the notes, you'll see a lot of details about it. It's a little speculative how these bones fit together. Here's another picture. You see this guy here doing an excavation. Here's a giant skull. And there's an Islamic story that the people of Aid, where the Quranic prophet Hud was sent, and they were very bad, they were giants, and they were killed. But the real story is there was a competition called something 2001, Watch 2001, I think. And it was designed to hosting people who could use their skills the best at manipulating photographs using digital editing programs. So this guy did it, and then he added this bogus Quranic story about the prophet going to these bad people, and they were all killed, but some people took it very seriously, and you get every now and then somebody saying this is what it was. Now, just to do a little bit of background, in Bereshit, Genesis, it says, in time when men began to multiply on the earth and daughters were born to them and the sons of God, so that the daughters of men were attractive, they took wives for themselves, whomever they choose. A little bit later, the Nephilim were on earth in those days. Now, some say that was sexual relations between fallen angels, and Nephilim were fallen angels, and the daughters, and that's why they were giant kids. But I don't think that really fits with the Hebrew. When it says daughters of men, the Hebrew word for men there is used as Adam, which comes from the same root as Adama, earth, the red earth. So Adam was made from the earth, or from the dust. And I think the real proper midrash of it is that men who are supposed to be sons of God and in the image of God and walking in the knowledge of God looked on the daughters of men, that is, looked on the daughters from the earthly point of view. They only looked on the physical side of who these women were. They just looked on their physical beauty, and they just got corrupted with the physical part of it. And so that's why they were fallen. They're only fallen in a spiritual sense. I don't really believe there was fallen angels that have relations with human beings. I don't think you can support that, although some of you may believe that, and that's your prerogative. But anyhow, so that's what I think the Nephilim are. Now, to continue the story, it says, and we were in our sight, kachagavim, as grasshoppers, something little and ugly and that devours the ground, and so we were in their sight. Now, how did they know what the Nephilim were thinking about them? There's really no proof of that. So some Rashi, I believe, was speculated they overheard a conversation. Okay, maybe they did. But maybe more likely, or maybe in addition to that, that may be true, but alternatively, they viewed themselves as such, and so they projected it upon the giants who were looking at them with apparent contempt, and that's how they viewed themselves, so that's how they figured others viewed them. So it says that they all took up, all the congregation lifted up their voice and cried, and they cried, actually they gave their voices and they wept, all the people, all that night, and that night that was at that time. And it says, and they murmured, they plotted, they murmured against Moshe and against Aharon and all the people of Israel. And they said to them, all the nations said, the congregation said, lu, which means would, or I wish, or it'd be much better if we had died, if we had died in the land of Egypt or in the desert before coming here, to died facing these giants or these giant opposition, this terrible opposition that we can't handle. And Lama, why did Adonai, sort of questioning Adonai as well, why did Adonai bring us to this land to fall? Now see, here's the same root. And maybe they're making a little joke. The Nephilim, and now we're going to fall by the sword. Actually, that was probably one of the swords right there that they were worried about that you've got there. Okay. And our wives, now Shenu, our wives, our women, and our children, our babies, and they would be a prey to be seized. Hello, wouldn't it be better if we were just returned to Egypt? So they made some plans to return to Egypt. And so they said every man to his brother, let's make a head, let's make a leader, and we'll go back to Egypt. So they had a full-scale rebellion plan. We're going to die. It's hopeless. The ship is sinking. Let's bail out. So here's what they really were doing. They thought of themselves as grasshoppers. Now, grasshopper is basically powerless. It's defenseless, disposable, without value. And I don't know of anybody who raises herds of grasshoppers. I've heard of people trying to herd cats, but that's not much very successful either. But they were contemptible. They were ugly. They were useless. They were of no great value. They entered into that lie of who they were. Actually, they were the army of God, and they didn't know that the people of Jericho already were, well, actually, that was 40 years later, but the same terror that would be on the people was going to be communicated. They were powerful. Now, here's a picture of somebody. Maybe, I don't think we need the house lights. Let's just keep the spots on, but let's dim the house lights. But this is a picture of a guy that was in the paper. The picture wasn't, but the story was. Elliot Rodger is his name. And he's sitting there in his BMW in his designer clothes, and he's recording his plan of retribution, as it's called. He had a 144-page manifesto, I suppose, on Facebook or somewhere, and he said the following. He said a lot of things, but this is kind of a highlighted point that was in the front page of the Kansas City Star about a week or two ago. He said, I'm going to enter the hottest sorority house of UCSB, that's University of California, Santa Barbara, and I'll slaughter every single spoiled, stuck-up, blonde chick, I hit a worse word, but anyhow, woman, that I see inside there, all those girls I've desired so much, they would have all rejected me. What was he into? The newspaper had a lot to say about it, but it was just such a crying statement. They would have all rejected me. Well, maybe he'd had a lot of rejection. I don't know. But Elliot Rodger was a 22-year-old who on May 23, 2014, killed 6 University of California Santa Barbara students, wounded 13 others, before killing himself in a rampage ignited in part by his misogyny, is how the newspaper's summarizing it. All-consuming hatred of women. I think that's a very superficial view of the plague that was in this young man's life, and to some extent is in all of our lives. Now, misogyny, if I'm saying it right, is hatred, dislike, mistrust of women. Rodger grew up in wealth. His father, Peter Rodger, is a photographer, director who worked on one of the Hunger Games movies. Some posit that Elliot's belief was that he was sexually overlooked emanates from a sense of entitlement. Of this point to a history of mental illness, narcissism. He referred to himself as a supreme gentleman. He said in his video, I will take great pleasure in slaughtering all of you. You will finally see that I am, in truth, the superior one, the true alpha male. Why? Because he believed a lie about people. He believed a lie about life. He believed a lie that he was rejected. He believed a lie that he was entitled to having certain attentions given to him. And we have just take the mouse and click restart later. Right there, yeah. And we'll upgrade Windows at some other time. But, okay. But the power, what I want to talk to you today about, to my own heart about, is the power of believing lies, believing half lies, believing big lies. What lies have contaminated our souls? What lies do we believe in our culture? Now, someone wrote this really wonderful statement. All of us receive messages about ourselves from the important people in our lives as children. We internalize these messages and carry them through adulthood with us, repeating them to ourselves as if they were gospel, as if they were Bible. When the messages are shaming lie messages, the internal voice chants them repetitiously. So we live in shame. We believe them and don't question them. And they can be shaming messages, and through our culture and through our world are shaming, destructive messages. And people can respond in different ways. And this man responded in great rage to these lies. Now, I'd like to do a little history. The first lie in the history of the known universe was in Bereshit in Genesis 3:1. And it says, "Now the serpent was more crafty than any wild animal which Adonai has made. And he said to the woman, 'Did God really say you are not to eat from any tree in the garden?'" Now, mind you, there's not an overt lie here. God, he's just asking a question. Did God really say this, that you're not to eat from any tree of the garden? But what there is an implication. Would God say anything that demanding, that demeaning, that constrictive? Don't you feel denied? Don't you feel like you've lost your entitlement? I spoke about entitlement a few months ago, and it's worth coming back to. Entitlement. What are we entitled to? If you're an American citizen, and I assume most or all of us here are, you are entitled to three things according to our Declaration of Independence. Life, even if you're in the womb, you're entitled to life. Liberty, freedom to express yourself and worship. And the pursuit of happiness, or originally it was the pursuit of property. You're entitled to pursue happiness, to pursue property. That's really all we're entitled to. We're not entitled to all the things that the culture says we're entitled to. We're entitled to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness or property. But the enemy is great at accusing God, accusing other people, sowing lies and sowing contention and sowing difficulty, so much so that that's actually the main title of the enemy. Hasatan means adversary or opposer. The great dragon was thrown out, that ancient serpent, also known as the devil and Satan, the adversary, the deceiver of the whole world. And here's what he does. Here's his occupation. He accuses them night and day before God. And the story in this verse is that he has been thrown out of heaven. He accuses. He accuses on three or four different levels. Three are listed here. He accuses God to us. Just like there was that insinuation when the serpent was speaking to Chava, to Eve. He says, "Did God really say this?" And of course, then she went and added to what he said, added to what God said, "You can't even touch it." And maybe that was a good precaution, but nevertheless, he got her questioning and challenging. And so Satan accuses God to us that God is harsh and God is leaving you in a barren situation and God's not going to come through for you and God's not going to answer prayer and God's not going to meet with you and God's loveless or harsh or difficult or challenging, or his words are such that they're going to be impossible to keep and impossible to be faithful to. God, he accuses, the enemy accuses God to us. He accuses others to us, that, and that's what this young man was dealing with, rejection. They will reject you. You've been rejected. You'll always be rejected. Nobody's going to love you. Nobody's going to care for you. Nobody's going to visit with you, and nobody's going to give you the kind of attention that you're demanding or wanting or expecting, and so there's rejection. And he accuses us to God, even. That is, you know, the story of Eov, of Job, where Satan appeared before the angel, the angelic court, and said to God, "Does Job really serve you for naught?" And he made accusations, and God entered into an amazing story of trial for Eov, for Job. So the enemy's accuser, sowing lies. Now, I'm going to make a statement that I think I can back up, that all sin ultimately starts with us believing some lie. In other words, sin really wouldn't be attractive if we believed the truth. So that it says of Moshe, after he had grown up, he refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He chose being mistreated along with God's people rather than enjoying the passing pleasures of sin. In other words, in order to sin, if you're tempted to steal, you have to believe the lie that you're entitled to that thing, or that you'll get away with grabbing that thing. Or if you tell a lie, You have to believe that somehow you'll get away with telling that lie. That, by the way, if you ever want proof of the fallen nature of the human race, you just look at some sweet little 2 or 3 year old, they're just learning to talk, and say they break something, they drop something, they take something they're not supposed to, and you ask them about it, and they'll say, I didn't do it. Now, who taught them to lie? Did they see their parents lie? Now, maybe they did, but hopefully you've been an honest example. Well, who taught them to lie? Who taught them to take truth and not follow it? I mean, computers take truth and they come to conclusions, and computers don't lie. Well, they sort of don't. I mean, depends on what kind of computer you have. But anyhow, they just frustrate you or me. But anyhow, but they don't lie because they're processing truth, and they believe A and B and it goes to C. But somehow a kid figures out that I can lie and maybe get away with it. I mean, assuming you can get away with it, your parents will believe what you say. And when we see sexual sin, well, God, I think, puts into our hearts some sense that there's supposed to be boundaries. We can't just do everything we want to do. We have to believe that we can get away with it and believe that there's no accountability. And so Yeshua is probably the prototype example of somebody facing very subtle lies, but half truth. Because the tempter came and said to him, if you're the Son of God, which is true, he is, order these stones to become bread, which he entirely had the power to do. So why not? What would be sinful in him making those stones into bread? There really isn't any exactly notable sin to that. He could do it. You could say that maybe he was commanded to fast 40 days, but I think it says the 40 days were over. He'd done the 40 days. So what was sinful about that? It wasn't actually a sin, except that under these circumstances, he would be just proving his identity by flashing his power, by showing his power before the enemy, and just, in a sense, exhibiting doubt. So he said, no, man shall not live by bread alone. And he's quoting Deuteronomy, Devarim, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God. He was just denying Satan his occasion to glory over him. But then the adversary took him to the holy city and sent him on the highest point of the temple. We probably believe that would have been the southeast corner of the temple. It was a long drop to the Kidron Valley. And he said, if you're the Son of God, jump. For the Tanakh said he will order his angels to be responsible for you, and they will support you with their hands. It's a quote, kind of a misquote, but a quote from Psalm 90, so they will not hurt your feet on these stones. So Yeshua could have jumped off the corner of the temple, that very high place. I think they say it's about 90 feet, about 9 stories up from the corner down, something like that. He could have done that. You know, he sort of had his own built-in hang glider that God could have kind of made for him, and he could have landed. But what was the sin? The sin, there's 3 forms of sin that are summarized in Yochanan, in 1 John. It says there's the lust of the flesh, and that sort of was exemplified in making the stones as bread. Satisfy your appetite by just showing your power. The lust of the eyes and the pride of life. This would probably be the pride of life, that Yeshua just could show and flaunt his power in any way and tempt God in any way. It's a half-truth, a very subtle untruth, but he says, no, you shall not tempt the Lord your God. In other words, don't do stupid things. That's a very good thing when you're getting into your car. Don't do stupid things. Don't tempt the Lord your God. Don't do stupid things and expect God to rescue you. God wants us to have reasonable prudence. So the third temptation, and it was based on a subtle half-truth, half-lie. The adversary took him up to a very high mountain, sort of similar to high prominence, but this is different. Showed him all the kingdoms of the world and all the glory. See, he had even better than Google Earth. He saw everything all at once. And he said to him, all this will I give you if you will bow down and worship me. Now, this one was even more subtle because Yeshua knew he was meant to be king of the world. He was going to establish the heavenly kingdom. And he knew this was his right. And I don't think Satan fully understood the execution stake and the sacrifices Yeshua had to make clearly, because he says they didn't understand it. Paul says that, Shaul. But He knew, Satan knew that his kingdom was at risk in some measure. And so he was offering Yeshua the kingdom and offering a shortcut to the kingdom. If you just bow down and worship me. And so, Yeshua, thank you. So Yeshua realized that, no, this is not the way to get the kingdom, even though I am a king. I was born to be a king. I was born to be a ruler. This is not the way to it. Satan specializes in half, subtle, half mixed truths about life, about people. And so I want us to just pause for a moment right now and just, what half-truths do we believe, especially about people, about rejection, about antagonism, about difficulties, about God not being faithful to meet with me and to bless me and to love me and to be faithful to me? Am I living in any half-truth worlds where God won't be faithful? And am I tempted to jump off of pinnacles, as it were, and show God's power and do foolish things, foolish investments or foolish ventures just to prove his power? Am I trusting him that he is a faithful and loving God? Am I giving people all the benefit of the doubt, or am I jumping to conclusions that this one's against me in that way, and that one's against me, and people are rejecting me, and people are looking down on me, and I am a grasshopper in somebody's eyes? That will lead you to great destruction. And my parents treated me, they may have indeed, but we want to get past that. We want to get to the place of forgiveness and truth. And truth. Now, in the spiritual realm, William Booth, the founder of the Salvation Army, and he proclaimed the following. I modified it a little bit, but he said, the chief danger of the 20th century, he was speaking in the 1800s, in the 19th century, or the beginning of the 20th century, he said, the chief danger of the 20th century will be religion without the Holy Spirit. And that's so important, that we have the Holy Spirit, our worship team, our sense of reading the Word and understanding the Word. Faith in faith. There's a whole faith movement. Have faith in your faith without Messiah. Faith in your faith. Forgiveness, receiving forgiveness without repentance. You know, forgiveness is vital. And Yeshua says a lot about extending forgiveness and receiving forgiveness. But we have to have repentance as part of it, renouncing sin. Salvation without regeneration. Saying we're saved because we prayed a little prayer, but we don't really have the experience of God working in our lives. Or politics without God. And that's gotten to be our culture. Heaven without hell. I don't speak much about hell, but hell is an eternal reality that is part of the spiritual dynamic of the Scriptures. And we need to have that in mind, that if we need to obey God, and ultimately if we disobey him, we will be in a place of eternal suffering, eternal loss. And so now, Hitler made up an interesting term when it comes to lies, a big lie. It's a propaganda technique. It was coined by Adolf Hitler in Mein Kampf, in his book, about the use of a lie so colossal that no one would believe that someone could have the impudence to distort the truth so famously. So he came up with this lie that the Jews were responsible for causing the Germans to lose World War I, and the Jews were actually undermining and causing, risking the extermination of the German people. And so because of his accusation, and that was kind of a monstrous lie, how could the Jewish people undermine the whole nation of Germany? But that was what he propagated, and he based upon that the idea that we need to have an extermination program for the Jews because they're trying to exterminate us. That's how he justified the camps. It was a lie so big that people just swallowed it whole. Now, one of his assistants, a guy named Joseph Goebbels, a Nazi propagandist, he came up with something that you still hear from time to time. If you tell a lie big enough and keep repeating it, people will eventually come to believe it. There's lies in our culture. And we're going to speak about some political lies and then some spiritual lies and bring this to Father's Day in a moment. But right now I want to talk about a lie that undermines a lot of our political life. It's the lie of the caliphate. The caliphate, and Glenn Balmer did a wonderful teaching on the whole history of the Islamic successions. But the caliphate comes from a certain Arabic term, and it's the Islamic state led by a supreme religious and political leader known as a caliph and a successor to Muhammad and the prophets of Islam. Now, there are some that think that Western imperialism caused the anger we see in a movement known today as militant Islamism. There is a little bit of subtle truth in that. If you like history, just there's going to be a lot of it here. If you don't like history, this may be torture to you. But our dear president, the first act he did when he came into office, or one of the very first, was he went to Cairo University, and he made a grand apology to the Islamic world for the treachery and failure and imperialism of the West and of the United States. A grand apology. I think that was a grand mistake, because that there was treachery, there was, we'll look at it a little bit, but that is not where the Arabic anger comes from. This is, if you're interested in history, this is all the, or not all, this is five of the different caliphates. Is about seven or eight of them all together, but the Ottoman Empire is the most recent one. And the Ottoman Empire was a Sunni empire. There's actually two forms of caliphate within Islam. And in the course of World War I, there was an agreement between the British, a guy named Sykes, and a Frenchman named Picot, an agreement. And they agreed, it was the United Kingdom and France, with the assent of Russia, defining where they would, how they would carve up the Ottoman Empire. The World War I was between Germany and the Ottoman Empire, Turkey, against what they called the Triple Entente of England, France, and Russia. And they negotiated a treaty, and the agreement actually looked like this, these spheres of influence. That is, the Ottoman Empire extended through vast swaths of territory, and the French were to be given control over this blue area, the Russians would be given control here, and the British would get control here. And if you notice, the borders of Jordan, here's the modern state of Jordan, it follows this line here. The borders of Iraq follow this line here, so Britain had control of this. The Arab Emirates are down there, and Lebanon and Syria were under French control, and this was all divided up. This really was blatant imperialism. In the land of Israel, wasn't called that, well, actually it was called that by God, but it wasn't called that politically then. The British were given control just of an area around Haifa, and there was supposed to be a joint protectorate under Britain, France, and Russia of the heart of Israel, and this was going to be British. But in fact, the British took all this, and this is looked on as a betrayal of the caliphate. And so there are people today who think that any land that was ever Muslim land needs to be restored to Muslim land. So right now, today, as we speak, there is a huge battle going on, the restoration of the caliphate. There's a group called ISIS, the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, is one of the ways of explaining it. And they right now control all this territory in Syria and this much of Iraq. They are Sunni Muslims, very radical Sunni Muslims. And they said, we have come to destroy the Sykes-Picot Agreement. We've come to remake history because the caliphate is the appropriate future. And I'll tell you what, no amount of apologies and nice talk is going to stop these people. They have an agenda out for destruction. And a number of terrorist groups have joined their forces, including the Baathist military commanders from the Hussein era. So actually, it's kind of interesting that Saddam Hussein's birthplace was in Tikrit, and the Tikrites are Sunni Muslims, and these Tikrites are joining with the ISIS, and they're very happy. It's kind of like Saddam's resurrection, in a sense. He's come back to power in terms of his followers being with this ISIS. The American-trained army left this great legacy behind. They left their helmets and ran. They collapsed in favor. Now, why am I saying all this? Well, let me say more of it. They took Mosul, which was a major city in the north. Mosul, they say, was ancient Nineveh, and the province is still to this day called Nineveh. But it's not just the fault of Obama. It's not just a recent issue. Bush made the commitment that our forces would be out in 2011, as I understand it. So it wasn't just a recent mistake in the last administration. It goes back to our basic idea that we think we can remake the Middle East. It was good for us, I think, to take out Saddam Hussein, but we took on a lot more in terms of... Now, I want to say this. ISIS is Sunni, and the Baghdad government is mostly Shia. And ISIS may take Baghdad and conquer all of Iraq, but I want to say this. Ultimately, it's not our problem. There's two forms of the caliphate today. There's the Shiites, Shia, which is Iran, and Assad in Syria, and the Hezbollah, and there's Sunni, the Saudis, the Jordanians, ISIS, Turkey, and Saddam's Baathists are Sunni, and they both believe in the lie of the destiny of the caliphate in two forms. Now, it's a very horrific thing that seems to be happening in Iraq, but it could be that it could be that the Sunnis, the ISIS, if they take over Iraq, will be in head-to-head conflict with the Iranians and take out the Iranian nuclear threat that we are all worried about, and they could eliminate each other. And I don't know how history is going to play out, but I'll tell you, we just need to be in prayer that God's kingdom will come. Hallelujah. Now, there's other political lies in our culture. Israel's to blame for everything, and I'm not going to get into all that because I want to get to the lie that has to deal with families. You'll get this if you get the notes. But lies about families. In our culture, we're not seeing a premium on two biological parents, male and female, as being important. Fatherhood is not viewed as that vital anymore. And a lot of the TV programs, you've heard this discussed, the TV programs, usually the father is not that he knows best. The father is some kind of doting idiot. And now, when I go through the following, there's a lot of research been done to prove, which you think was needed to be proved, but to prove the importance of fatherhood. Now, having said this, I don't mean to denigrate. I want to give a disclaimer. There may be here single parents. There's no father for your child, and you're aching over that. And I understand that, and I'm not meaning to make your suffering worse. And there may be people, there may be dads or men who are childless. They don't have kids, and they're grieving over that. Or you have estranged kids. But what we want to do is honor the concept of fatherhood, because all of us had fathers, good or bad, absent or present. We all had a father, and we want to honor the concept, the reality of fatherhood. So let me show you some things to break the power of these lies and just give us a little picture. Paul Raber notes in his new book, Do Fathers Matter? What science is telling us about the parent we've overlooked. The death rate of infants when the father is not around prior to their birth is 4 times higher than when the prospective father is present helping to support the pregnant mother. How does the kid know that his father's around? Well, there's something deep in the kishkas of an individual that recognize the father's voice. In Sweden, not exactly a conservative country, a team at Uppsala University found out that just reading a book to a 7-year-old daughter and similarly asking a 16-year-old girl about school helped prevent depression and other psychological ailments in the kids decades later by a father doing that, is what the research was about. Children whose fathers played with them, read to them, took them on outings, helped them care for them, had fewer behavioral problems in the early school years and less likelihood of delinquency or criminal behavior as adolescents. Among disadvantaged children born prematurely, those with engaged fathers had higher IQs at age of 3. So how does the dad affect the kid's IQ? I don't know. We just must breathe something into them that just has an effect. Children with involved fathers were less likely to smoke as teenagers. These are all statistical things. I've got the documentation in the notes. Ross Park of the University of California, Riverside is focused on the social development of children, U.S. children whose fathers were away at war when their children were 4 to 8 years old, had problems with peer relationships. The same was true for the sons of Norwegian sailors who were away for months at a time. Children of fathers who engaged in the most physical and enjoyable play had the highest ratings. They were better at socializing. Their fathers played with them. Play remains a central part of the interactions between children and their fathers throughout childhood. Now, some of you may have seen this movie, Honey, I Blew Up the Kids. Anybody saw that movie? A few hands here. Yeah, well, this guy's a nerdy scientist, and he has a machine that shrinks and blows up. Anyhow, this was his 3-year-old, and somehow got in the machine and became, like, I think 20 feet tall or something. He just, you know, all his molecules expanded. And so then he was going to get into that same machine because he had to talk his kid into getting into the reversal machine, but he had to talk the little baby, was maybe 2 or 3 years old, a little toddler who was stomping around the city and causing great havoc playing with stuff. And he had to talk the kid into getting into the sights of the machine that would reduce him. And so he said to his wife, let me get into the sights of the machine so I can blow up and I can talk to our son. And she made this famous line that I love, that I think is worth quoting, and I got it right there. So she says, no, I'm going to go, not you. Because if he sees you, he knows daddies are for fun and mommies mean business. Anybody agree with that? All right. Well, that's good. Make sure, daddy, you are for fun. And even if your children are adult kids, spend time with them and do what you can in terms of recreation and meals and visiting and just to have fun together, laughter together, because it's known to be psychologically, physically, morally, socially, in every way helpful. The scriptures are true about the blessing. When fathers exert too much control over the play, instead of responding to their children's cues, so you could also be a control freak in the playing, their sons can have a more difficult time with their peers. Daughters, who are the most popular, enjoy playing with their fathers, had the most non-directive fathers, as fathers who listen. American Enterprise Institute report in April found that teens with fathers involved were 98% more likely to graduate from a college than those who were very involved, and those with very involved fathers had 105% more likely to graduate. One or two more statistics, and we're done. And would the worship team come back up, please? We didn't pick a song, but we want to have something to honor the dads. Psychologist Sarah E. Hill of Texas Christian University, for instance, presents data showing how a father's absence is associated with accelerated reproductive development and sexual risk-taking in daughters. The last point is this. The president's last statistic. The president's recent initiative, Opportunity for All, My Brother's Keeper, to address fatherlessness, listen to this, does not, according to the White House correspondent, Neil Moreau, he said instead of the family being the core American value, the president promoted the idea that community performs the function. So he did an analysis. He said community gets 34 mentions in overcoming fatherlessness, government gets 15 mentions, federal gets 54 mentions, state gets 60 mentions, local gets 32 mentions, but there's not one mention of marriage or married in this doctrine to promote fatherhood and build up the family. So what's the conclusion? Children need a father, and preferably their biological one, not just anybody. They need an involved hands-on fathering that cements the connection of the man responsible for their birth. Mentors and fathers are needed, but they're not sufficient to meet a child's need to experience the touch of their dad's hand, his unconditional love. Dads, keep pouring it out. Dobson said one time concerning estranged children, he said, be relentless, keep seeking and loving and blessing, unconditional love and voice reassuring him or her, you are my son, you are my daughter, I will love you, I am proud of you. So the power of believing lies, half lies, big lies, what do we believe? God's spirit of truth counters these attacking, shaming lies. This is what Sozo is about. We deal with lies that people are living. His love lifts up our heads. He gives us double honor to replace the shame we feel about ourselves and that others. Break the power of shame. When you're in proper relationship with God and self, you can fulfill the destiny that you were created for. It's vitally established and rooted in truth. Now, interestingly, in a Jewish wedding ceremony, we've had some weddings on this bima, and the chuppah is set up, or maybe even a bigger chuppah. And in the ceremony, the man comes up and he stands first, and if people want to do it, it's a wonderful tradition that the bride comes up and she marches, she processes around her husband. Some do it 3 times, some do it 7 times, some do it 13 times. There's different traditions. And so what is she illustrating? What is being illustrated by that little custom? Well, she's the image of grace and intricacy and beauty. She's more likely the one who has grace to dance and to do the elaborate and beautiful things in the home. Men are creative too, but the wife, just as the word wife actually in English comes from weaver. She weaves the fabric of beauty and warmth and comfort in the home. But his job is to be the pillar. His job is to build a place. Actually, the word husband means band around the house. The one who stands firm in biblical truth, stands firm to give a safe place for the family to live and to grow, a safe place emotionally, a safe place spiritually, a place that's safe and true and strong. So Corinthians says to men, gives us this exhortation. This is my last screen. And I'll do it in three different translations. Stay alert. Stand firm in the faith. Behave like a mensch. And that's a little bit of a Yiddishism. Behave like a man. Behave like a responsible person. Grow strong. Let everything you do be done in love. In the New American Standard, be on the alert. Stand firm in the faith. Act like men. Be strong. Let all that you do be done in love. So here it's very specific. Act like men. Be a man. This is the essence of manhood. Being strong, being stable, being loving, being an example of loving, standing firm in the faith. Your wife doesn't have to talk you into going to shul, talk you into Bible reading. You're standing. You're solid. You're the rock. You're the pillar. Be on your guard, watching for things that go wrong. Again, stand firm. This is translation. Be men of courage. Be strong. Do everything in love. I'd like to invite all the fathers that are here today to come up. We have a present for you. We want to bless you. We want all the wives and sons and daughters to extend their hands of blessing. So if you have kids, come up. Gentlemen, and this isn't designed to make you feel bad if you're single or if you're childless. We just want to honor fatherhood. We want to honor dads. And I didn't forewarn you. Hallelujah.